Spain's decarbonization journey is a fascinating one to look into. The country is known for being an early adopter of renewables, but the same isn't necessarily true when it comes to the decarbonization of its transport sector. In fact, although there are some very positive policies, uptake has been a bit slow, especially when we compare with other European countries. To really dive into the topic, I got Pier Paolo Cazzola and Matteo Craglia on the line, two experts on the transport and energy sectors who work at the University of California Davis's European Transport and Energy Research Center, based in France. Both have worked at the International Energy Agency and International Transport Forum, advising governments on a range of energy and transport topics. I'm Yusuf Latif, and this is episode one of the special edition Energy Transition miniseries. Enjoy the episode. When it comes to mobility in Spain, what is the current state of its decarbonization? In particular, how have things been faring on the e-mobility front? Matteo, do you want to give some insight?
So for decarbonizing transport, we're strong believers that electrification will play the largest role in the decarbonization of the sector. And Spain has made significant progress on electrifying its transport fleet. The latest numbers, hot off the press, for the first half of 2025, are that 17% of new car sales were electric. So that's not bad, 17%. It's and I would add, even in June, just the June numbers are 20%. So there is progress driven by the EU's emission standards. However, we have to also contrast that then with other countries in Europe, and the European numbers was 24% in 2025 compared to 17%. So Spain should arguably be at least in line with the European average. But, you know, is making progress. And the government has put in place a large number of subsidy programs to help promote the adoption of electric vehicles. In many of these countries, especially in Southern Europe, subsidies are still seen as being necessary to help consumers make that jump into cars that are more expensive up front, while they may not be more expensive over the lifetime of the vehicle. So Spain has offered subsidy schemes for a long time, even since 2009, and up to today has already spent around 1.3 billion on subsidies. So they've put their money where their mouth is, I'd say, but they could do more, basically. They currently offer around €4,500 for the purchase of an electric vehicle, either a plug-in hybrid or a battery electric vehicle. But there have then been a few political challenges with those subsidy schemes as well. So it was cancelled in January by the Spanish Parliament, notably by coalition of the rights-leaning parties, and then was hurriedly restarted again in April. And at the moment, now this latest round for this year allocates around 400 million towards subsidies for electric vehicles. However, there are some caveats with that, unfortunately. 200 million of those 400 million are to pay for subsidies from last year that still haven't been paid out. So there's been some challenges with handing out subsidies, which, you know, starts to reduce trust in the system and reduce the adoption of electric vehicles. So there's already been significant delays. Often people had to wait more than a year to get their subsidies after having purchased their vehicle. And the second challenge in Spain is that the money is given from the central government to the autonomous regions of Spain, who then have to apply for this money and then distribute it to the consumers themselves. And when this new subsidy scheme was announced in April, the regions had 3 months to apply for this money, but only, I think, around 10 regions didn't apply in time by July, meaning that, you know, that's going to further delay subsidies being distributed in these countries. So there's been, I guess to sum up, there has been notable adoption of electric vehicles, but some of the real challenges has been in the actually distributing those funds to consumers, and has been sort of the implementation of the policy and the relationship between sort of central government and these autonomous regions.
Pier Paolo, anything to add there?
A couple of things. It's not only, let's say, critical. I think there are some interesting aspects of the subsidies in Spain, the presence, for example, of price caps, which make them more oriented towards low-income households or more relevant for those. This could be done in a way that is stronger, similar to what has happened in France with the social leasing, but it's a development of the EV subsidy policy that tries to bring in more equity elements. So this is not begins to exist in Spain, could be going further there. Also, when it comes to decarbonization, Spain has a significant shares of low carbon energy sources, low carbon electricity. More than 75% is low carbon, including nuclear, and about more than 50% is renewables. So this is in the context of a transition to electrification is relevant. Above global average is depicts, let's say, a situation which is net positive, definitely.
Hi, Laurie here from the Enlit Europe team. Are you ready to drive the EV revolution? Then join us at the Mobility Zone at Enlit Europe, 18th to 20th of November in Bilbao. This is where transport meets energy, bringing together utilities, regulators, OEMs, charge point operators, and innovators from across the value chain. The Mobility Zone puts you at the heart of the action. Don't miss it. Be part of the conversations shaping the future of mobility at Enlit Europe in Bilbao.
There's clearly a lot to unpack here, right? We've got subsidies, we've got government incentives, and then we're touching on the renewables area, which we will, of course, go into. But I want to hone in on the infrastructure. So when it comes to charging infrastructure, from what you've seen, are the numbers where they need to be? And how do they compare when we kind of consider commercial versus private fleet electrification?
So finding the numbers of exactly where these chargers are is quite challenging, unfortunately. But there has been a wide deployment, I would say probably in line with EV adoption. So it has been growing, just it remains, you know, slightly behind European levels. By 2025, there were now 44,000 charge points in Spain, which is around one charge point for every 10 cars, electric cars. So it's not bad. It's similar to levels we've seen in some other southern European countries, such as Italy. But again, arguably should be far more, also for a country that is historically a large automotive manufacturer, has an interest in promoting electric vehicles for its own domestic manufacturing capabilities, it should arguably be further up. I would add that it's been quite split between the autonomous regions. There have been, I guess, as you might expect, more charger deployments in Catalonia, Barcelona, and in Madrid. But we've also seen in other regions that it's not just based on the wealth of the region as well. Some lower income, you know, average income regions such as Andalusia have actually seen quite considerable adoption of charge points as well. So it's been quite patchy between regions. And again, this sort of is because of some of these challenges between getting these fundings from the central government through the autonomous regions down into consumers' hands. It's been more of a policy implementation challenge, I think. The actual policy itself has lots of sensible nuances in it. For example, smaller companies or medium-sized companies can get extra bonuses to subsidies for charging infrastructure. And also for small villages or towns with less than 5,000 inhabitants, they can get extra bonuses to the subsidies. So the way that the policy has been written and developed, I think, is very sensible and is often actually even an example for other European countries. The challenge has really been just then in its implementation of actually getting it out and getting it built.
So very much challenges that are very Spain specific, right? That kind of how things are broken down in terms of all the different regions. It's very interesting. And you've brought up again this kind of comparison with the rest of the EU, because obviously this is a policy issue. When we look at Spain's neighbors, I think it was you or Pipalo who mentioned how in Portugal, perhaps things are a bit different. Spain is clearly an automotive, has automotive strength, but Portugal doesn't. So I wonder, how do they compare in terms of EV uptake, considering that difference?
This is a really interesting comparison between Spain and Portugal, because you would think that they would be in a very similar position and that Spain, as the wealthier of the two, would be further ahead. And nothing could be further from the truth. In, as I say, so 2025, the first 6 months, Spain were at 17%. Portugal, they were at 33% of new car sales. A third were electric. And this, even if you consider that a quarter of cars that go to Portugal are used imports, they're still far ahead of Spain. Portugal has three times the number of EVs on the road per capita as Spain. It has 40% more charge points per person than Spain. And it has more than double the number of charge points for every electric vehicle on the road. So they've really been ahead. And I think there's lots to learn there. Part of it, as we mentioned, thankfully, Portugal doesn't have some of the challenges of having to deal with different layers of government as much as Spain. But things that I think have been particularly successful in Portugal have been for companies that they can fully exempt the purchase of a battery electric vehicle from VAT and company taxes. And that doesn't happen in Spain. Spain offers for companies a subsidy of around 2,000 or 3,000 euro, while as in Portugal, you can exempt the entire value of the vehicle. I mean, that can be a vehicle of around 40,000 euro. That's a really big incentive for the companies to also start adopting them. For private households, Portugal actually offers smaller subsidies than Spain. So they've offer between 3,000 and 4,000 euro per vehicle compared to Spain's 4,500 plus a scrappage scheme that can take it up to 7. So but that's, again, even more interesting that Portugal has managed to achieve all of this, even offering smaller subsidies. So it really shows just long, consistent funding over a significant amount of time without changes in political direction too much can have really significant impact.
Yeah, just maybe to add on the infrastructure side, I understand that Portugal has been particularly dynamic in supporting an integrated infrastructure framework, including roaming, so easing roaming. So this is a combination of different actions. Some is encouraging the installation of charging station with financial assistance and the roaming, and then streamlined permitting. So this also led to eased as EVs, as the number of EVs grew, is also eased the development of the infrastructure. Normally they go in parallel. The more electric cars you have, the higher is the density of the charging infrastructure for economic reasons. If you don't have vehicles, the economic case for the infrastructure is weaker. So it's weird to see one popping up enormously while the other one doesn't follow and vice versa. But still at the end, this has been resulting in a success and has been strengthening what has happened. So what Matteo mentioned on the vehicle side.
I think just to build on there, there are clearly a lot of strengths to talk about here, a lot of advantages that both countries have in different respects, right? And Pier Paolo, earlier you mentioned how in Spain, especially, there's this low carbon uptake, low carbon technologies, and that's what they're kind of known for. They've got huge renewables. They've got a lot to brag about in the renewable sector. And now we've talked a bit about Portugal's strength in e-mobility, and I kind of want to compare the different elements between the two countries. What have they been getting right? And what do you think they can learn from each other?
One thing we didn't talk about is, let's say, the aspect of vehicle manufacturing. So Spain is a powerhouse of vehicle manufacturing in Europe. And it has been taking action to support, let's say, the transition of vehicle manufacturing towards electric mobility. So this is something, this is important. Normally, if you are a country that has a greater production capacity, you are more exposed to risks if you don't ensure that that production capacity adapts to the technological development. So the case of Spain is a case where we have seen major manufacturers investing in the conversion of existing facilities that were, let's say, producing internal combustion engine vehicles into with the idea of shifting towards battery electric vehicle production. We have seen some plants being taken over by others with the intention to move towards production of electric vehicles. There's also investments that went on specific projects through joint ventures to manufacture batteries. One of the latest examples is a plant in Zaragoza. And there are others being that have been announced and they are beginning to be constructed. So this whole development of the manufacturing side, which I think is ahead of the curve even in European terms, is a positive one and very much needed, I think, in this transitional phase. And it's an area where, I mean, Portugal is less established, let's say, as a manufacturing powerhouse for the automotive sector, but still has companies and active economic activity linked with that. So it's, I would say, in this case, Spain is probably an example. You mentioned also the renewables. I must say, actually, Portugal has been doing fairly well on renewables, especially with the strong acceleration in recent years. And I think if you discount the nuclear, Portugal may even be ahead of Spain in terms of renewable share. So it's not bad. I don't think the Portuguese should be feeling somehow ashamed on their performance in that respect.
I think, Matteo, earlier you mentioned that this kind of cross-comparison between the situations in the two countries is pretty interesting, right? Anything to add there?
I agree with everything that Pier Paolo said, that both Portugal and Spain have been driving their renewable adoption very quickly. But in 2025, both Portugal and Spain had over 30% of their electricity come from renewables. Sorry, from solar power specifically. So over 30% of their electricity came from solar power. So they're really pushing what is possible. The challenge then remains, can that be stable on the grid? Obviously, we know that there was this recent blackout in Spain, which the investigation found did not have anything to do with solar power. It was more about managing the grid. But I think that's going to be one of the real challenges for Spain moving forward, is how to integrate all of these new electric vehicles, all of this new renewable energies, and make it all work together in a grid. And my understanding is that Spain is a little behind in updating its grid compared to many other European countries. But governments now, is obviously because of this blackout, has seen this as being a priority. So June is a very fast moving topic at the moment. But in June, the government proposed new legislation that would help to update the grid, but it was voted down in July. So it hasn't happened yet, unfortunately, because it was very ambitious regulation to start updating many of the things in the grid, in particular around some of the flexibility services that are needed. My understanding is that Spain doesn't have what's known as a voltage regulation services. And this in particular is having batteries on the grid to even out the dips in electricity demand linked to renewables and sort of link supply and demand. So the UK has 5 gigawatts of batteries on the grid. Italy has 1 gigawatt, while Spain has 60 megawatts, which is not much at all. And so they have so much solar, but they don't yet have all of this additional infrastructure, whether it's batteries or grid, to then make that work in a super reliable manner. But, you know, lots of this legislation that was proposed in June aims to fix many of these things. So there is attention on this topic.
I'm really happy you brought out the blackout because, yeah, I could talk for a day and a half about the situation. I know also because it also obviously hit Portugal as well. And I know that in Portugal, they announced this package of measures to boost storage, which obviously is much needed. So, I think all eyes are on the countries and how they approach this topic as EVs kind of have to be brought online. And I kind of want to use that as a segue into the next question. We've talked a bit now about the hurdles, perhaps storage being one of them, and their integration onto the grid. What are the most significant challenges when it comes to really ensuring that there's widespread EV adoption in Spain? And on those challenges, how realistic do we feel that they can be overcome?
I think one general issue, not only exclusive to Spain, is more generally the case across Europe, is the fact that in the European market, electric vehicles tend to come from the premium segments, so they tend to be more expensive. And of course, for southern European countries, this is a bigger challenge. In general, the income per capita is lower, and this means that access to more expensive vehicles is more challenging. So Spain is part of that. I think part of what can help Spain is a generalization of the availability of EVs across different market segments. In a way, the Spanish government has been pushing for that by putting, for example, the caps on the subsidies, price caps on what can actually be subsidized. I think also that the fact that the European regulation is moving up will generate greater availability. And so that can actually help also, specifically Spain, to embrace more strongly the electric vehicles. Second aspect is the administrative complexity and the delays that were mentioned by Matteo earlier. It's proven, let's say, that if you immediately can see the effect of the public policies on your wallet, so you're happier about trying to make an investment decision than if you don't. So in that sense, and I think that the difference between Portugal and Spain, which adopted slightly different approaches there, is telling. So that's probably an evolution, I'd say, of the way the framing of the subsidy programs so that they don't lead to complexities and delays in terms of delivering the benefits. This, I think, could also help. There's work, I understand, also to do on the avoiding fragmentation in charging networks. Again, a good example in Portugal in terms of like ensuring easy access, no matter where you are, for different EV owners. And then there's the reform of permitting, which is not only related with the grids, but also related with charging installations, which is something that has been accelerating over the past few years after the RePowerEU plan, I would say across the EU, but still needs specific member state policies for like accelerating and easing implementation. So I would mention, yeah, maybe more coordination between local, regional, and national authorities, given the challenges that Matteo also flagged on this topic, would also help.
We talked a bit about the grid, and I kind of want to go back to that and ask, what is the role of collaboration in all of this? There's so many different stakeholders, there's so many different parties, whether it's grid operators, utilities, OEMs, policymakers as well. How will collaboration come in, and how important is it in the wider scheme of things?
Collaboration is crucial on the grid side because you have several stakeholders. There are some positive developments. Recently, I understand that in April 2025, Spain launched something called REVE Map, which provides real-time access to 25,000 public charging stations across the country, which means basically you know what's the status, whether it's free, whether it's not, whether you can access it. And so that's a development. It's a positive development going in towards, let's say, the provision of, well, first, cooperation in terms of collecting the data, and then second, the provision of consumer-facing information that is real-time, is up-to-date, and helps in, let's say, growing confidence that you will be able to charge if you need it. So that's a good thing. There are other examples of partnerships. They can take different forms across partnership across stakeholders. You can have, let's say, utilities partnering with consumer-facing companies such as retail shops or supermarkets to actually deploy public charging at those facilities with joint investments. You can have also investments by utilities and let's say traditional refueling networks for the deployment of fast chargers, for example, along the motorway axis or the main trunk roads, which is where essentially you need that fast charging to top up for your EV if you travel long distance. So there are examples on these. I understand, for example, in Spain, Iberdrola has been partnering with BP on these, amongst others. And there are also actions that have been taken by specific automakers, like or groups of automakers in the form of joint ventures to deploy, or either as a single one-sided, let's say, choice or as a joint venture to share costs to roll out chargers. I think this has been especially relevant for fast chargers. There are examples of networks like Ionity, now also Mylens in the case of heavy-duty vehicles. They are basically joint ventures by automakers aiming to enable access to fast charging along those major trunk roads. Challenges there are on the price, because you need competitive pricing in order to ensure a high capacity utilization. And at the beginning, competitive prices means you need to face some initial phase where you're exposed to potential losses. So then, in summary, data sharing, joint investment, regulatory framework also help. Europe has a strong regulatory framework with AFIR, Alternative Fuel Infrastructure Regulation, requiring minimum deployment. So combination of public investments, we mentioned subsidies before. This can be strengthened, and then the better job done by Portugal in terms of ensuring an integrated network of chargers and roaming. So this is an area, let's say, of improvement. This MAPA-REVE, which I mentioned before, in a way moves Spain towards that, but there's still a margin to improve there.
Pierre touched on one of the areas where I think there will need to be the most coordination will be the adoption of heavy-duty vehicles, electric heavy-duty vehicles, which is coming, will be cost competitive, we think will take the majority of the market. There have been a crazy amount of studies now that the sensible ones show that electric vehicles will have play a very major role. But that really does require top-down coordination led by the government to make sure that there is sufficient charging infrastructure in place. Particularly for these types of vehicles, you need to preemptively update grids in certain locations. And the existing way that we update grids is not made for that. It's traditionally has been demand-led. The grid operator gets sent a request of, we have 100% clarity that we will need a little bit more charging infrastructure in 4 or 5 years' time. Whereas now we need to do the opposite, and we need to say, in these specific locations, which the government can help coordinate, there will be, in future, in the next 5 years, a heavy-duty vehicle recharging station hub. The grid needs to be updated preemptively in this area, even if there aren't yet the fixed requests and the demands for charging infrastructure companies that actually want to install the chargers yet, but you need to start updating the grid in these areas preemptively for it to happen.
Yeah, maybe one thing, this is great, Matte. I fully agree the heavy duty and grids are a case that requires very strong coordination. So I want to reemphasize that too. I must say that there are different ways to charge a heavy duty vehicle. One is at a depot. And one is on high-power chargers along major trunk roads. The depot charging is something that, seen from like the single heavy-duty vehicle, can come with lower power requirements. than the major trunk road. But if you begin to aggregate all the, like in large depots, all the demand that you may actually have from several trucks, you end up having like potentially very significant electricity demand at that single point, like if you take this from like a network perspective. So that's an example of where, and frankly speaking, I think the depot will be probably a cheaper way to access electricity for heavy-duty vehicles, and meaning that acquiring better visibility on where the heavy-duty vehicle charging demand will pop up, where are the depots, how they are, how far they are from the high-capacity power lines, how should they be connected, how long will it take to actually do that, can we shorten that time, this kind of work that brings together as a logistics sector and grid operators with potentially the government or the regulators or facilitators of those exchanges. I think this could really be making a big difference in terms of speeding up the transition of heavy-duty vehicles towards electric, with depots being the early phase of that transition.
You touched on a lot there, and I think it's great that we bring in this kind of, because we talked about the map of charging points that's happening in Spain, Reef. We've talked about integrating all of this onto the grid. We've talked about heavy EVs. There's clearly so much momentum, and I think as digitalization in the sector only kind of increases in terms of what we can see and the data that we have on the sector, it'll be a very interesting space to watch. Speaking of that momentum, and we've talked a lot now, I think we've kind of created a very good picture of how things are going in terms of decarbonization of the sector and in terms of e-mobility. But do you think there will be space for any alternative technologies to assist with the decarbonization of the sector?
Okay, I think Matteo mentioned this a few times, and so I'll reiterate it. I think we were both convinced that it will be hard to beat the transition towards electric mobility when it comes to road transport. And this is the case for light and heavy vehicles, and it's driven by reasons that have to do largely with economics. Electric vehicles are far more energy efficient than any other technological option. The low carbon electricity has already become, I would say, very attractive from a price point perspective. Batteries, including for stationary storage, have falling prices. So the strength, although now we need public support, as Matteo mentioned, for with the subsidies, but also for like supporting the technological transition on the industrial side, we're convinced that over time, these technology will end up becoming self-sustaining and or has the entire capacity to become self-sustaining. It will be tough to walk through that phase because, you cannot subsidize forever, for example. At some point, subsidies will need to be phased out. Taxation will need to kick in. Some countries are already, for example, imposing road user charges on electric vehicles in order to pay for the roads and the maintenance of the road. This will need to come. In a steady state environment, that needs to be paid by the EV. In the transition, we will need to help with that. But we're convinced that then it's going to be really hard for other technologies to compete. Candidates include hybrids, but hybrids still rely on fossil fuels in the context of a transition. You will need to reach net zero. So that remaining reliance on fossil fuels is going to be a challenge. They can be complemented with biofuels or synthetic fuels, but the, let's say, well-to-wheel emission reduction of biofuels depends a lot on the way the biofuels are produced. History shows that we have been relying for the bulk of the biofuel production on food and feedstocks, which are now being phased out according to European legislation. And net of major change in the whole agricultural sector towards, let's say, low carbon fertilizers, precision agriculture, so lower use of fertilizer overall, it was going to be difficult for biofuels to be available at scale in a way that is aligned with the requirements of the reducing emissions. E-fuels are an alternative, but they are currently very expensive. They require enormous amounts of electricity, so they're much less energy efficient in that respect compared to e-mobility. So although potentially they could come at price points that compete with biofuels, if you have like enormous amounts and very cheap renewable electricity available. So still on the top of it, you will still need chemical plants to make conversion. So it's going to be a challenge. E-fuels are derivatives of hydrogen. Hydrogen per se can be an energy carrier, but it's a very complex molecule to handle. And transport is a very distributed energy demand compared with, let's say, industrial uses. So producing it on site, it's possible, but it's not going to be easy. And also fuel cell vehicles, which are the best way from an energy efficiency standpoint to use hydrogen, remain much less energy efficient than battery electric. So we see structural challenges for alternatives, and we think irrespective of that, if even if some of these manage to succeed, this would happen, let's say, not without a parallel very significant role of electrification as a way to enhance energy efficiency in any case, and enhance and ensure cost optimization. So voila.
I think you put it nicely that it has to happen in parallel. Matteo, anything to add?
People like to talk about, what is the role of these different fuels? I'm going to be quite controversial and say that they're an afterthought, that the vast majority is going to be electric. And there's so much debate on, what is the role of these? Like, they might be, they're the niche applications to fill in what we can't do with electricity. And what we can do with electricity just continues to expand and expand and expand. Electric buses, for example, should all be electric. In Spain, in 2025, only 18% of new buses were electric, compared to Romania, Latvia, Hungary, Lithuania, Netherlands, Belgium, Sweden, Denmark, all had almost 100% of their new buses were electric. So Greece and Romania have almost 100% of their buses are electric, and Spain is still at 18%. This is an easy win. We know it's cost competitive. Yes, you have to do a bit of upfront investment, but that'll last you forever, for the next more than one vehicle lifetime. That's a no-brainer, and that should be where the discussion lies, rather than trying to think about where some particularly challenging fuel, how that could fit into it, is their afterthoughts. And another example someone we work closely with, Andreas Kammel from truck manufacturer Traton, always likes to bring up, is if you want an example of why hydrogen isn't going to happen, look at China today. Where China today, hydrogen is available at 3 euro per kilogram. It's fossil hydrogen, and it's still not being adopted. So, if everything is in place in theory to have cheap hydrogen, but electric buses are still cheaper and they're the ones being adopted. So, we can learn also as Europe, looking at what others are doing, and the leading market at the moment is China. So again, just as further proof that it's not really going to happen anytime soon. Perhaps that's a little controversial, but I think sometimes these hard things need to be said for us to actually stop debating and start acting and start getting vehicles on the road and getting this the infrastructure built to support them.
On the plus side, let's say, for these alternative fuels, there are sectors, in particular aviation and maritime, where especially long-distance aviation and long-distance maritime transport, where it's going to be really hard to make sure that we're going to succeed just with electrification. So those sectors will probably need fuels, also in a very low-carbon environment. So those are probably the sector where there's the greatest merit in considering seriously what can happen from sustainable biofuels and potentially also e-fuels. I do think that if you look at how stakeholders in those sectors are acting, there is a really serious consideration of this. There is concern, for example, that if biofuels get used at scale in road, there won't be sufficient supply to cover the needs of aviation and maritime. There are people in the aviation sector that cheer the development of electric mobility in road, so because that will free up availability of lower carbon fuels at lower cost points for the aviation sector, for example. So there are sectors where these things will matter, where these options will matter. We're just thinking that for transport, given the technical and commercial and economic circumstances, electrification will play a stronger role.
Pierpaolo, Matteo, thanks again for joining us on the Energy Transitions podcast. To you, the listener, I hope you enjoyed this first episode, diving into all things Spanish e-mobility. Tune in next week, where I will have as a guest Jorge Munoz Riesco, head of smart mobility for utility giant Iberdrola. In the episode, we will be discussing further e-mobility in the country, but with a more in-depth conversation around elements like smart charging, vehicle-to-grid technology, and the evolving nature of collaborations between the automotive and the energy industry.